Welcome to the Epigenetics Podcast from Active Motif. Join host Dr. Stefan Dillinger for lively discussions with leading epigenetics researchers. Hear about their past experiments, what they're working on now, and what's coming next. You know their papers, now get to know them and discover the stories behind the science.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Epigenetics Podcast. Today I'm happy to welcome Mark Partoon from Ohio University on the show. Please let me briefly introduce you to our audience. You got your PhD from Indiana University in 1992. After that, you moved on to a postdoc at Northwestern University, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And since 1998, you are a professor at the Ohio State University. A question I like to ask every guest to start off our little podcast is, how did you become interested in biology in the first place and then pursuing a career in science?
So that's a good question. And I wish I had one of those answers that I always hear on this podcast about people have this, you know, they've been science prodigies and they've always wanted to do this. Mine was sort of accidental. I started college as a pre-med major and then very quickly realized that I was way too squeamish to be a doctor. I could never do that for a living. And so I was undecided for my first 2 years of college. And then at the start of my junior year, I had to pick a major. And I looked through the list of majors and I thought biochemistry sounded like the smartest major. And I had no idea what it was, but I picked it just because I thought it sounded impressive. And then once I ended up taking biochemistry, then it turned out I loved it. And then, you know, so I picked it sort of by luck but I turned out to love it. So
let's talk about what you end up doing then, being your science, and that centers around the analysis of a mouse knockout of the enzyme histone acetyltransferase 1, HAT1. But maybe we can start by talking a bit about your earlier work to ease into the topic. When you set up your lab, you started working on HAT1P, and you are basically still working on it today, as I just said. The first thing you did, though, was to identify a role for HAT1P and HAT2P in telomeric silencing. Can you talk about what got you interested in these proteins and what you found about the function of the both proteins in telomeric silencing?
So I started my postdoc in the lab of Dr. John Whittam, who unfortunately has passed away, but was a tremendous scientist. And I went to his lab as a grad student. I did all biochemistry. It was protein purification and characterization and things like that. And so I decided to do something different. I got hooked on chromatin from reading Jerry Workman's papers from when he was a grad student in Bob Rader's lab. That got me hooked on chromatin. And you know, it wasn't a very big field at that point. This was 1991, 1992, when I got interested in chromatin. And so I went to John's lab. I was going to do biophysics. I thought I should do something different. And he's a great biophysicist. And then after about 2 weeks, I realized I absolutely hated biophysics. There's a lot of math. I'm not good at math, and it's very tedious, sort of, you know, from day to day. And so I told Johnny, you know, I wasn't really excited about the biophysics, and I was thinking about trying to come up with a new project. And a couple of days later, he said to me, you know, histones are known to be acetylated, but nobody's ever found an enzyme that acetylates them. That might be an interesting project. And I said, yeah, that sounds interesting. And so I went. This is back in the days you had to go to the library to read about something. So I spent a couple of weeks in the library looking up papers about histone acetyltransferases, and the literature wasn't very big at that time. A few people had tried to purify them, but nobody had ever gotten very far. There were some big name people like Bruce Alberts and Roger Kornberg and people like that had tried to purify HATs, but hadn't gotten very far. So I started this project to try to purify a HAT. And so, you know, this was in 1992. I started this, and in John's lab, I did, you know, sort of all the basic biochemistry. It was, you know, sort of brute force stuff. This is in the days before epitope tags existed, and genomes hadn't been sequenced, so you sort of had to do this brute force. And you know, I did all the sort of conventional chromatography, and still it was only partially purified. I had like 5 or 6 purification steps, but it still there was a ton of bands on the gel. And so this is where I got lucky again, in that John Whittam was a friend of Roger Kornberg's, because John had been a grad student at Stanford. And so he apparently was talking to Roger on the phone and had mentioned that I was trying to purify a hat. And so Roger said, told John that they had made a bunch of a 30 amino acid peptide that was the H4 N-terminus that had a cysteine on the end so you could attach it to a column. He said, we've kind of given up on the project. Would you guys like this? See if you guys can use it. And so John said, yeah. And so we got this peptide that we could use as an affinity column. So we had a peptide. I made two columns. One was the normal histone H4 tail peptide. And then I made another one where I chemically acetylated all the lysines. And so I figured that the acetylated version would look like the product of the acetylation reaction. And so the enzyme would not bind to that, whereas negatively charged proteins that were binding non-specifically would still bind. And so I ran those in series. And then when we did that, we had this beautiful gel, two bands. One was 42 and one was 50 kilodaltons that had the histone acetyltransferase activity. And so, and we knew which one of those two bands was the correct band. And so that was where the whole project started of HAT1. But it took us a little while to get that. There was some unfortunate, at the time, it's hard to imagine this now, but at the time, John Whittam had a little bit of funding problem. And so I had to switch labs, and that's how I ended up in Dan Gotchling's lab. So John was at Northwestern, which is on the north side of Chicago, and Dan Gotchling was at the University of Chicago on the south side. And so I sent Dan a letter and I explained the project and I talked to John, and he said I could take my project with me since I had started it, which, you know, it was enormously generous of John. And Dan let me come to his lab and continue working on what I wanted to work on. And so during this time, I moved around mid-1993, I moved to Dan's lab. And so I had, at this point, we knew the two bands on a gel, one of the two, we knew which one was the HAT. And we were trying to get protein sequence. So this, again, before all the genomes were sequenced. And then around this time, Dan invited Dave Alice to give a seminar at the University of Chicago. And so Dave and I got to be friends because he was working on, so this is before Dave was famous. He was at Syracuse University at the time, and he was trying to purify a HAT. And so there weren't very many of us in this little club trying to purify HATs. And so we got to be friends, and you know, we would exchange reagents, and like the InGel assay, he sent me that protocol way before it was published because he knew that I had an enzyme. And so I sort of had the positive control and so confirmed that it actually worked. And so, you know, we got to be good friends exchanging a lot of things. And then we eventually got protein sequence. And then, you know, we were trying to clone it. And at this is the days when yeast was first being sequenced. It was the first organism that had its genome sequenced. And every few months, another chromosome would get released. And so every time there was a chromosome released, we'd check our protein sequence against the new sequence. And then eventually it came out in mid-1994. We got the sequence of the enzyme, and that was very exciting because we knew it was kind of fun because we knew that nobody else on the planet knew what a histone acetyltransferase looked like except for us. It was very cool. But at the same time, Rolf Sternglanz was following the same enzyme genetically. And so we were sort of in a race at that point. And we were able to express and purify the enzyme in E. coli and show definitively that it had an activity. So that was great. So that was the first histone acetyltransferase. The problem was that it had no phenotype when you knocked it out in yeast, which was incredibly disappointing. And so I joked that that's why David Alice is famous and I'm not, because HAT1 didn't have a phenotype. And so Dan, who is a tremendous scientist, didn't want to try it. I wrote up a paper, you know, describing this, but Dan didn't want to publish it because without a phenotype, he didn't think it would be a cell paper. And so he wanted to wait until it was a cell paper. And so that's why we ended up publishing in 1996, you know, sort of after Dave published the GCN5 paper, because we didn't publish it until we found the second subunit, which what we called HAT2, which turned out to be a homologue of the human RBAP46 protein. So RBAP46 or RBBP7, which is a component of many histone modification enzymes now, or enzyme complexes. So HAT2 turned out to be this RBAP46 homologue. And at the same time, Paul Kaufman and Alain Varreau had found the yeast CAF1 complex in yeast, the chromatin assembly factor 1, and it had a subunit called MSI1 that was the RBAP48 homolog. And so these two proteins were very similar. And the fact that the HAT and the chromatin assembly factor had a subunit in common was interesting enough to be a Cell paper. And so that's where we end up publishing the Cell paper because we had the similarity of CAF1.
So this Cell paper took you, what, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, no, it was most of my postdoc to get that Cell paper. But it was fun. And so I got sort of very possessive of this enzyme. And so I always sort of think of it as my enzyme. And
of course.
So I spent a long time trying to figure out what it does. I want to be the one who figures out what it actually does.
So what you then found, or what the next step was, that you characterized it further, obviously, and you found a function in double strand break repair, right?
Right, right. Yeah, so the problem, like I said, was the enzyme didn't have a phenotype when you knocked it out. And so, you know, a couple years later, after we found it, Michael Grinstein published a paper where he showed that so HAT1 acetylates lysines 5 and 12 on newly synthesized histone H4. So that's the important thing it does. And David Allis had shown several years earlier that, as far as we can tell, all eukaryotes acetylate newly synthesized histones on lysines 5 and 12. So it's this universally conserved mark of new histones. So for some reason, the cell wants to know which histones are the new ones. And so, but Michael Grinstein had published a paper showing that you can mutate lysine 5 and 12 on histone H4 in yeast, and there's no phenotype. And so that sort of took the wind out of people. So, you know, like, well, is this really doing anything? And so we had, our idea was that there was functional redundancy between H3 and H4, because we know that both H3 and H4 tails are acetylated on newly synthesized histones. So we thought maybe there's redundancy. And so what we ended up doing was we had a strain that we got help from Michael Grinstein and constructed this in Dan's lab, where you had only one copy, where you could put the only copy of the yeast H3 and H4 was on a plasmid. So we could make mutations. And what we ended up doing was making, for all 5 lysine residues on the H3 tail, we made every single permutation of single, double, triple, quadruple, and quintuple mutants of those lysines, and then combined those we were desperate to find a phenotype. So we combined those with HAT1 mutants, and with specific combinations, we could see phenotypes in things like telomeric silencing and then double strand break repair. So that was a long slog, but we ended up finding there was in yeast lysines 14 and 23, when combined, if you mutate those combined with HAT1, you do see phenotypes.
And what was the phenotype?
So one was they would lose telomeric silencing. So heterochromatin at the telomere is required HAT1 in this acetylation of H3. And specifically, homologous repair of DNA double strand breaks.
Okay.
So those were the two phenotypes we were able to find in yeast.
Okay. And then there was a paper in Morcell in 2004. And this was interestingly, a two-author paper. And you found a link between type B histone acetyl transferases and chromatin assembly. And this probably goes in the direction where you are working on right now. Can you talk about how you found this link and what this meant?
Yeah, no, so this was, like you said, this is a two-author paper. And the first author was Shi Ai. She was a graduate student who, I had a very small lab at Ohio State, and she came to me one day, and she had been working in another lab for 4 years and had a falling out with her advisor, and she was looking for a new lab. So she was 4 years in, plus she was 6 months pregnant. And so I needed a graduate student desperately. And so I could tell she just was super smart. And so she joined the lab, and I gave her this new project where, by this point, epitope tags existed. And so we had tagged HAT2. And while we had originally found HAT1, HAT2 complex was cytoplasmic, we found that it was also highly prevalent in the nucleus as well. And so her project was to purify the nuclear form of HAT1. And so even though she was 6 months pregnant, in 2 years, she had put together a two-author molecular cell paper characterizing this enzyme. It was an extraordinary effort on her part. But we found a couple of cool things from that. One was that in the nucleus, there was a third component of the complex that was a protein called HIF-1, which was unfortunately named. So in those days, when you worked in yeast, when you found a gene, you could name it. And so Rolf Sternglanz, who had also isolated HAT1 genetically, he had found this protein as a 2-hybrid interacting with HAT1. And so he'd called it HAT1 interacting factor. But he hadn't figured out what it was, and so he'd never published it. And so we found it, and I tried to convince him that HIF-1 was a terrible name because everybody's going to think it's hypoxia-inducible factor. But he insisted that we keep it at HIF-1. But what we found was that HIF-1 had a very slight similarity to the N1 histone chaperones from higher eukaryotes. And so she did a great job showing that this HIF-1 protein was an H3-H4 chaperone, just like N1, and it could load H3-H4 tetramers onto DNA. And so this sort of showed a direct interaction between the histone acetyltransferase that acetylates newly synthesized histones and a chromatin assembly factor. And so that was a very nice sort of connection that we were able to show. We'll add some more biology to the story. And that also led to a couple of other papers. Another great graduate student named Huan Yu Wang. We noticed that HIF-1 was an H3H4 chaperone and N1 was an H3H4 chaperone. But there's this protein called NASP, nuclear antigenic sperm protein, that was in the same family as N1 and HIF-1. And in the literature, it was a histone H1 chaperone. And so we thought that was kind of odd. And so Huan Yu did some beautiful experiments showing that NASP actually is an H3H4 chaperone. And so the literature had sort of gotten it wrong. And she had characterized the chaperone activity of NASP. And so that was the first demonstration that NASP was actually an H3H4 chaperone and not an H1 chaperone, which was difficult to publish because nobody believed that it was we were bucking the trend. But it's been shown definitively now. It's a very important H3H4 chaperone involved in sort of buffering excess histones in eukaryotic cells. So a lot of things came out of that paper.
Yeah, one thing you also looked at was H4 lysine 91 acetylation. So this modification no longer lies at the tail of histone H4, but rather at the core. And most proteins would interact with the tail, I would imagine. So why is that important and what did you find there?
Yeah. So this actually also came out of that same paper. So in addition to HAT1, HAT2, and HIF-1, this nuclear HAT1 complex was stably associated with H3 and H4. And when we did the mass spec on H4, we found this lysine 91 acetylation. And this was around the same, this was just after Fred Van Leeuwen, who had replaced me in Dan Gotchling's lab, had found that H3K79 was methylated by DOT1. And that was the first core domain modification that was found. And we had looked at lysine 91, and we thought it was interesting when you look at the crystal structure, because it's sort of buried in the core of the nucleosome. And when you sort of look at it in more detail, it's in the middle of the interface between H3H4 and H2A and H2B. And in fact, the lysine 91 makes a salt bridge with an aspartic acid residue in H2B. And so we proposed that modifying this residue would regulate tetramer-dimer interactions. And so perhaps it might have a role in chromatin assembly where, if the tetramer gets assembled with this modification on lysine 91, that modification has to be removed before the dimers can come in, and that maybe regulates the kinetics of tetramer-dimer assembly. And so we showed then that if you mutate that residue, you destabilize the octamer and dimers fall off more quickly. And so I think that was the first histone modification that was shown to be to directly regulate a histone-histone interaction rather than histone DNA or histone interaction with another protein. It directly regulates histone-histone interactions. And we stopped working on that quite a while ago, but it's been fascinating to see that residue has turned up in human diseases. So there are neurological disorders where people have mutations in H4 lysine 91. And so it turns out that is biomedically relevant as well. So that's sort of great, very gratifying for us.
So the next big step in characterizing HET1 was that you constructed a conditional mouse knockout model of HET1. This was in 2013. And yeah, you moved away then from yeast, right, to more complex organisms. Can you maybe describe the process of creating this mouse and what you learned from that?
Yes. So you know, I had, as a grad student, I worked on yeast. As a postdoc, I worked on yeast. In the beginning, I never occurred to me I'd work on anything other than yeast. But as we were kind of slogging away with these phenotypes in yeast and having to make all these mutations in histone H3, it just started to become clear that eventually we were going to hit a dead end where it was going to be hard to get any further, because if your phenotypes rely on mutating histones globally throughout the genome, it's going to be impossible to sort of really pinpoint what the enzyme is doing, because there's always the argument that you're having these pleiotropic effects of having these histomines. And so I got lucky, then also came into play here is around this time I had gotten a couple of job offers. And so the university gave me a little bit of money to stay. And what I did is I spent that money to get this mouse model made. So I paid a company and they made a mouse knockout. And then I hired a postdoc's name, Prabhakaran Nagarajan, who's still with me. He's a research scientist in my lab. And so he's managed our mouse effort. And so as the mouse knockout, as it turned out, mice are a much better organism to study HAT1 than yeast, because the mice have much more interesting phenotypes. And so if you completely knock it out, the mice either die just before birth or they're born alive, but then die very soon afterwards. And it turns out that these mice die because there's a developmental defect in the lung where cells hyperproliferate. And so the space where the alveoli normally form gets sort of crushed, and the mice aren't able to breathe because there's sort of hyperproliferation of cells in the lung. And so these mice also had these interesting craniofacial defects where some of them would be born completely lacking in their lower jaw, and some of them, all the bones in the face would be sort of fused together. So they have these very weird developmental defects. And so, because they grew long, they survived long enough to make it through embryogenesis, we could then make mouse embryonic fibroblasts from wild type and knockout cells. And that's been sort of the model system that we've relied on a lot in the more recent past.
So the acetylation of newly synthesized H4 occurs in the cytoplasm. And the function of this acetylation is typically ascribed to roles in either histonuclear import or deposition. I'm using those cell lines you just mentioned. You investigated this. So what did you find then using your cells?
No, that's a good question. So we, and I think everybody else, had kind of assumed that this acetylation of newly synthesized histones had something to either to do with the import of histones into the nucleus, or it had to do with getting them on the histone, or getting them on the newly replicated DNA. And that's because the acetylation occurs, like you said, in the cytoplasm. And then after the histones get assembled onto DNA, over 30 minutes to 2 hours after being loaded onto the DNA, they get deacetylated. And so there is this temporal correlation between acetylation of the new histones before chromatin assembly and then their deacetylation after chromatin assembly. So we kind of assumed that somewhere between those two steps is where HAT1 was, where this acetylation was having its effect. But as it turned out, we showed that in mice, if you knock out HAT1, you lose acetylation of newly synthesized H4 completely, and you lose acetylation of newly synthesized H3. So it's really a perfect model system for trying to figure out what is this acetylation of new histones doing. And as it turns out, there's absolutely no defect in nuclear import, and there's no defect in getting the histones onto the new replicated DNA. That all works completely normally. And so, that sort of left us, hanging, because, you know, that was what we always thought, that's what it did. And so obviously we're going to have to look somewhere else. And, in sort of a follow-up to that initial paper where we knocked out HAT1 in mice, I had another absolutely spectacular graduate student named Paula Agudelo-Garcia, and she joined the lab. And one of the many projects that she worked on was this beautiful proteomic experiment where we combined pulse labeling or heavy isotope labeling of both wild type and knockout MEFs, so that we could distinguish using mass spec proteins that came from the wild type from proteins that came from the knockout. And then she pulse labeled the cells with EDU for 30 minutes. So she's growing the cells, one's heavy isotope labeled, one's not. She pulse labels them both for 30 minutes to label newly replicated DNA. And so David Cortez from Vanderbilt had worked out this beautiful technique where you pulse label cells with EDU, and then you can biotillate the newly replicated DNA, and then you can purify nascent chromatin away from old chromatin. And so
to see which histones are there.
What's that?
To see which histones are on the newly synthesized DNA. Yeah,
right. And to see what other proteins are on. So we could see all the proteins that are on newly replicated DNA. And so she compared nascent chromatin from HAT1 wild type to HAT1 knockout cells. And she found a couple of interesting things. One was that the H3 and H4 were unacetylated in the knockout. Another interesting set of proteins that was depleted from nascent chromatin in a HAT1 knockout cell were bromodomain containing proteins. And so this is interesting because bromodomains are domains that bind acetylated lysine residues. And so one of the things we think the acetylation of newly synthesized histones does is it recruits specific bromodomain-containing proteins to nascent chromatin, where they then have specific effects on nascent chromatin. So we think that's a key thing, that why these newly synthesized histones are acetylated is that they recruit bromodomain proteins. And she also found made a very interesting observation that when you compare nascent chromatin from a HAT1 wild type to a HAT1 knockout, in the knockout cells, you have an increased amount of a bunch of proteins that are involved in constitutive heterochromatin formation. And so there's more heterochromatin on nascent chromatin from a knockout than on a wild type. And so that led us to the idea that perhaps this acetylation of new histones is in some way regulating the balance between heterochromatin and euchromatin in the wake of DNA replication.
Did you find a difference in the amount of histones or nucleosomes that are present on the same sequence of DNA?
That's a good question. So we find that all of the core histones are about 25 or 30% more abundant on nascent chromatin in the absence of HAT1. And so it's as if they're sort of more tightly packed than you would see in a wild type cell.
I would have expected the opposite, right? So that
we expected the opposite too.
So yeah, okay. Another thing that people are looking at nowadays is like aging, right? And the influence of different factors on the lifespan. You also looked at this process with your with HAT1 and what influence has HAT1 on those processes.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yes. And so this came from a great observation from Dr. Nagarajan, who, you know, we had these, you know, the mice were, the HAT1 knockout mice were lethal, but to sort of keep generating these, we had this large colony of wild type and heterozygous mice. And he noticed that the heterozygous mice died much earlier than a wild type mouse. So the heterozygous mice look pretty normal when they're born, but their lifespan is only about, their average lifespan is about 68 weeks or something like that, which is much shorter than the lifespan, you know, the wild type mice live easily 2 or 3 years. And so the knockout mice die a little over a year. And he noticed, turned into a very long, laborious project, but ended up quantitating that these mice that were heterozygous would develop a lot of phenotypes that are consistent with premature aging. So these mice would become hunchback when they were very young. Their muscles would atrophy. They would lose the subcutaneous fat. You know, old people, their skin is very thin. They don't have a lot of, the mice would do the same thing. They would have no subcutaneous fat. They would get cataracts. They would often die of this histiocytic sarcoma, which is a cancer that's usually only found in old mice. And so we were able to show by a variety of experiments that HAT1 is required for normal lifespan in mice. And so we're still pursuing that. And that sort of has in some ways dovetailed with our more recent work, where we think there's an interesting link between HAT1 and the acetylation of newly synthesized histones and the nuclear lamina.
Yeah, that would have been my next question, right? Because you have you have like a disturbed balance on heterochromatin on this new chromatin or the new DNA, and heterochromatin is in general located more to the nuclear lamina or at the nucleoli. And if you have like a disturbed balance in heterochromatin, would this then influence like the structure of the nucleus or the localization of different chromatin regions to different places of the nucleus?
Right. Yeah. So after Paula had seen this imbalance in heterochromatin and euchromatin, another grad student, Ludmila Popova, decided to look at this in an epigenomic way. And so she first did ATAC-seq in a wild type and a knockout cell. And what we found interestingly was, it's kind of hard to describe in words, but if you think about what ATAC-seq data looks like in euchromatin, there's just a lot of peaks. It's very densely, it's very accessible, a lot of peaks. And then we have these regions of heterochromatin where the peaks are very scattered. So there are still ATAC-seq peaks in heterochromatin, but they're, tens or hundreds of kb apart. And so what we found was that in a HAT1 knockout cell, the heterochromatin becomes almost completely inaccessible. So those remaining ATAC-seq peaks that you see in heterochromatin go away completely when you get rid of HAT1. So we're forming some sort of hyper inaccessible heterochromatin structure in the knockout cells, and these regions of hyper inaccessible chromatin that we call HAT1 dependent accessibility domains match up very nicely with lamin associated domains that are regions of chromatin that associate with the nuclear lamina.
So indicating that HAT1 would play a role in this process, and that when chromatin is replicated, that the heterochromatin gets more heterochromatic even more?
Yep. So, and she also showed using ChIP-seq with H3K9 trimethylation that specifically in these lamin-associated domains, in a HAT1 knockout, you get an increased density of H3K9 trimethylation that goes along with the decreased accessibility. And so this has kind of led us to the model that we're currently studying. We think what the acetylation of newly synthesized histones is actually doing is it's regulating the read-write mechanism of heterochromatin inheritance following DNA replication. And so I don't know if people are familiar with that, but a lot of labs have done really great work showing that in regions of heterochromatin for H3K9 trimethylation and K27 trimethylation, the enzymes that are responsible for those methylations bind to the same modification. So for example, the SUVAR39 enzymes bind to H3K9 trimethylation. The PRC2 binds to H3K27 trimethylation. And the idea is that that recruits these enzymes to the parental histones following DNA replication. So what one important, I guess we should have talked about this earlier, but one important thing to remember is that following DNA replication, all right, so when the replication fork goes through a stretch of chromatin, it knocks off all of the histones. And an important aspect, especially in heterochromatin inheritance, is that those histones that get knocked off, the H3H4 tetramers, are grabbed by components of the replication machinery and then put back onto the newly replicated chromatin very close to where they started. And this is what's thought to preserve the spatial memory of where heterochromatin is supposed to be, right? And so since you start with one duplex before replication and you end up with two, that means you've got half as many nucleosomes on the newly replicated DNA as you started with. And so that's where these newly synthesized histones come in, and they fill in the gaps where the parental histones went to the other strand. And so nascent chromatin is a one-to-one mixture of parental histones and new histone. Okay. And so the big challenge in epigenetic inheritance is that those new histones have to be modified to match the old histones to preserve chromatin structure. And so it's thought that this read-write mechanism recruits the H3K9 or K27 methyltransferases to the parental histones, and that puts them in the vicinity of the new histones where they can then transfer that methylation, and you can get restoration of the original chromatin structure. And so the hypothesis that we're working on is that the acetylation of the newly synthesized histones is negatively regulating that read-write process so that it slows down the spread of the histone H3K9 or K27 methylation and allows for orderly assembly of heterochromatin structure. And so in the absence of new histone acetylation, we think that the read-write mechanism works too fast or works more extensively than it's normally supposed to. And that's what leads to this inappropriate heterochromatin structure.
Or is misregulated because the cell just doesn't know which histones are new because you put some other histones there. Maybe.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, or the histones are there and they're unmodified. So we think in some way that the acetylation state of the new histones is a signal that these histones shouldn't be methylated yet. Whether that's because there's bromodomain proteins binding to those histones and it's directly preventing the methylation transfer, or it's the acetylation itself is blocking the methylation transfer, we're not sure. Or we've actually shown that HAT1 localizes the nascent chromatin as well. Whether it's directly regulating the enzymes, we don't know. But we think that that's what the newly synthesized histone modifications do, is regulate that read-write inheritance of heterochromatin structure.
So for the last almost 40 minutes, we have been on a journey through your scientific career. Did we still miss something important? Would you like to add something?
So the only other thing I want to mention is that is an important collaboration that is a big part of my scientific career that was stuff we didn't mention, and that was projects I've done with a colleague named Mike Freitas, who's a mass spec expert here at Ohio State, and we met in 2003 at a cancer center meeting, and I was in line for lunch, and there was this guy in front of me talking to a group of students about the histone code, and I was like, I didn't know anybody else at Ohio State worked on histones. And so I introduced myself, and it turns out he was an analytical chemist who was using histones as a model system for developing methods to detect post-translational modifications. And so we got together, and this was in 2003, and he showed me his data. And so he was, I think, the first person to, in an unbiased way, use mass spectrometry to globally map histone modifications. And he showed me he had identified about 50 new sites of modification on the core histones. And interestingly, one of those was K91. And so we had already had the mutants and we could show that that did something important. And there were some other modifications that we made, mutations, and showed that they were had interesting phenotypes in yeast. And so we thought this was a really exciting paper. This was just after the K79 was shown to be methylated. And now we've got like 50 core domain modifications that no one knows about. And so we thought this was great. We sent it to Molecular Cell and they laughed at us and sent it back. And we sent it to Genes Development and they sent it back. We sent it to JBC, they sent it back. And then we eventually, it was in press at Chromosoma. So we sent this to Chromosoma as we wanted to get it out. And then it was funny that summer, before the paper came out, I think it was a FASA chromatin meeting in Snowmass, and I did a poster about this, and people seemed very interested in, and I think Bob Kingston was the organizer. He said, you know, people seem to be interested in this. Would you like to give a talk about this? And I said, oh yeah, that'd be great. So I gave a talk and I explained the mass spec and showed all these new modifications, and people thought that was great. And right after my seminar, this guy comes running up to me and he's an editor from Science. And he said, well, we'd love to have a paper about this. I said, you know, we could have used you about 3 months ago. nobody was interested in it before, but that collaboration has led to an enormous amount of, fun science that Mike and I have done together. And he's been a big part of my career. And we did a lot of collaborative stuff with looking at leukemia and clinical trials of epigenetic modifying drugs and all sorts of stuff that I never would have gotten into had we not accidentally been in line next to each other at lunch. So I just wanted to recognize Mike for all his contributions to this as well.
Yeah, again, luck and coincidence playing a role.
Luck and coincidence. And the other thing I found as when I became a PI is that it all comes down to the students. If you get good students, you can do well. And I've been fortunate to have a lot of great students in my lab. And I have a couple of students now, Caden Martin and Eliza Ozer, who are following in those footsteps and are doing great stuff. And so hopefully we'll be getting their work out in the near future.
So you need to be a good recruiter.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. If you can't recruit good students, yeah, it makes life tough.
So imagine, and this plays into the work they are doing, you are due to submitting a grant proposal tomorrow. What would you have written into that?
So what we would write into that is the idea. We're combining our idea about a modification of newly synthesized histones regulating that read-write mechanism, heterochromatin formation, with the reassociation of the nuclear lamina with chromatin following DNA replication. So if you think about, there's a physical interaction between the nuclear lamina and heterochromatin. So things like lamin B receptor bind to HP1 and things like that. So there's a direct physical interaction there. And so when you go through DNA replication and you knock the histones off the DNA, by default, you're dissociating DNA from the nuclear lamina. And you have to recreate the proper heterochromatin structure to reestablish that interaction between the chromatin and the nuclear lamina. And we think DNA replication plays an important role in regulating what's associated with the nuclear lamina and what's not. And that this acetylation of newly synthesized histones and its repression of the read-write mechanism creates a window by which you can regulate whether or not a particular stretch of chromatin is associated with the nuclear lamina. So that's what we had write about. That's what we're interested in now, mm-hmm. in seeing if this connection between DNA replication and the nuclear lamina.
So during our email exchange, when setting up this interview, you mentioned that, and this is a quote now, I was fortunate to be around before chromatin epigenetics became such a big field. So it has been a lot of fun seeing this field develop. So what did you exactly mean by that? And what were the developments that fascinated you most?
So it's funny. When I got into chromatin, it was just because it was this interesting question of how is it that you have this billions of miles of DNA in your body and it can be compacted but still be functional. I thought that was a fascinating biological question. And, you know, in the early 1990s, there weren't a lot of people working on this. It was not in fashion, but there were people like David Alice and you know, the people like there's a lot of people. I feel bad if I start naming names that I'm going to miss people, but there were a few people that were doing really pioneering stuff in chromatin, you know, like Michael Grinstein and Marion Carlson and Ira Herskowitz, when they isolated the switch diff complex. Those were the kind of things that changed people's mind. But in the early 1990s, it was strictly an interesting biological question. This idea that epigenetics would be such an important player in biomedical research, I think, at least I don't think it occurred to a lot of people. It certainly didn't occur to me. And I've put together this class a couple of years ago about epigenetics. And one of the things that as I go through the history of this, I show if you search PubMed for epigenetics and disease, there are no papers until 2000, and then it goes up exponentially. So this idea that epigenetics was going to be central to biomedical research and to human disease, it really didn't come about until the mid 90s, when there were all these seminal work being done with people finding the HATs and the HDACs and the ATP dependent chromatin remodelers. And you know, there was this huge boom in the late 90s where all these things were being discovered, and it was an incredibly exciting time. And it was fun to be there sort of at the beginning, before it was, you know, when it was a small community and you could know everybody that was in the field, to what it is now, when there's, you know, thousands of labs working on epigenetics related research. But it's been remarkable to watch that progression.
That's true. So thank you, Mark, for your time and for being on the show.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Epigenetics Podcast from ActiveMotif. We hope you enjoyed it. You can find all the mentioned references in the show notes. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. We'd love to hear from you, so please send us your feedback on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or via email at podcast@activemotif.com, and we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. For more great epigenetics content, check out the ActiveMotif blog at activemotif.com/blog. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.